You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 14th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. It's 2000 in Beijing, 1300 in Warsaw. Midday here at Midori House in London and 8 a.m. in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Emma Nelson, and coming up on today's programme.
On this vote, the yeas are 352, the nays are 65, one present, two-thirds being in the affirmative, the rules are suspended, the bill is passed.
Could TikTok be banned in the US? The US House approves a bill to outlaw the social media giant. Also ahead in Berlin, a meeting of European leaders. What can Olaf Scholz, Emmanuel Macron and Donald Tusk achieve together? And we'll be in Sao Paulo for this week's Global Countdown.
Hello, Emma. So today's Global Countdown will be very special. It's going to be my little guide for new Brazilian music.
All that coming up right here on The Briefing with me, Emma Nelson. We begin by an approval by the US House of Representatives of a bill that could impose a ban on the social media giant TikTok. It would give the platform's Chinese parent company ByteDance 6 months to sell its controlling stake, or the app will be blocked nationwide. American legislators have long been concerned about Beijing's influence over TikTok and the privacy of user data. Well, the bill passed the House by a landslide, but must still be approved by the Senate. Charlotte Henry is a journalist and author who runs the Edition newsletter and podcast about the intersection of media and technology. A very good afternoon to you, Charlotte.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Just explain to us, very well, thank you, and great to have you on the programme. Just explain to us how popular TikTok is in the United States. One would imagine it is as pervasive as it is in great parts of the world.
Oh, the numbers are extraordinary. I think it's about something like 170 million Americans use it. Apparently, it saw a 45% increase in monthly active users from July 2020 to July 2022. It's become completely pervasive, particularly with people who are, how can I put this delicately, younger than us, Emma.
And the fact remains that that's very delicately put, by the way, Charlotte. Thank you. But most grateful for that. The fact remains that it has been actually quite problematic as well for the likes of the White House, hasn't it? Because they recognise that TikTok does have an enormous presence in the lives of lots of people, namely their young voters. Yet they do recognise it as a security threat.
Right. So there's a couple of bits to unpack in that. The first thing to note is Joe Biden does actually have a TikTok account. He turned down doing the very, very prestigious, very big deal Super Bowl weekend interview that normally the president of the United States does and launched a TikTok account. He's done a few videos on there. So it appears to be good enough for him at the moment. But yes, you're right. There are security concerns, particularly around data storage. And there were stories about Chinese workers accessing non-public US user data, so that there have been some controversies around that. And I think there's a kind of political element to this as well, right? We, you know, you and I can laugh at the TikTok users being younger users normally, but for a president whose age has become quite a big deal, shutting down the young person app might not be such a good look either heading into an election.
So how would this ban work?
Well, that's quite an interesting question. As you said in the intro, the idea is that ByteDance sell its stake. Because TikTok has actually moved, it says, its US user data to US data centres. So they're saying that, and in Singapore as well. And in the EU, it goes to a data centre in Ireland. So they're trying to prove, basically, that the data does not get held in China with all the risk that that is perceived to have. So there is that going on. And I get the ban. The truth is, I'm not sure quite how practical a ban could be if it passes the Senate, which I'm not convinced will happen, because, you know, people could use a VPN to download an app and use it. It's not so clear cut.
And you mentioned there the fact that the demographic of TikTok users is distinctly younger than the US president himself, despite the fact that he has his own TikTok account. If a ban were to come in place, how angry would this make a swathe of the young American electorate?
Oh, I'm sure there'd be a host of people who operate both kind of for fun on TikTok and professionally within the creator economy who would be furious. TikTok, I think, have set up various sort of lobbying operations with these influencers to try and convince American politicians not to ban it. People have built whole careers using this app, so I'm sure there would be a huge backlash.
And tell us a little bit more about the wider scope when it comes to the US's relationship with China. This is clearly a very direct and obvious and easily understandable hit at Beijing, isn't it?
I think that's what it's meant to be. We saw some quite grueling questioning by American politicians of the boss of TikTok, if you remember, not so long ago. And there was this quite uncomfortable exchange where one of the politicians was very aggressive with him. And he kept saying, look, I'm Singaporean. I served in the Singaporean army. It was all kind of, I think what you're getting at is right, that this is a bit of a proxy for a lot of the tensions between the US and China, particularly when in economic terms. And I think that's right. And I'm guessing that this is American politicians kind of see this as a bit of an easy win and a bit of an easy hit. But I wonder if there's not the potential for it to backfire in the sense that, you know, Chinese or other nations could say, well, let's ban this American app, or you know, we don't trust this American service, or, you know, there could be perhaps unintended consequences as well.
Just tell us briefly, do you think the ban will come into place?
I'm not convinced, just because I'm not convinced that this is about the only thing American politicians have agreed on since about 2016, isn't it? So I'm not convinced that it's going to get over the final hurdle in the Senate. It's not clear that that will happen. And of course, that is the next part of the process. So it's not a 0% chance this will happen, but I'm not totally sure how close to 100 it is. I think it's got a long way to go.
Charlotte Henry, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Briefing with me, Emma Nelson. A quick look now at the day's other news headlines. Here's Tamsin Howard.
Thanks, Emma. The far-right Dutch politician Geert Wilders has abandoned his bid to become the country's prime minister. His Freedom Party won the most votes in last year's election, but needed support from other political parties to form a coalition government. A high court in the northern Japanese city of Sapporo has ruled that the country's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. LGBT unions have split lower courts and are opposed by the ruling party, despite widespread public support in Japan. And Poland's new pro-European government has recalled 50 ambassadors appointed by its right-wing predecessor. The country's foreign minister said the change would mean better professional implementation of the difficult tasks facing its foreign policy. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Emma.
Thank you very much indeed, Tamsin. Now, does the traditional Franco-German axis have a third, potentially strong voice in the shape of Poland? With Donald Tusk's return to the political stage as the country's prime minister and the country bordering Ukraine, Warsaw now plays a pivotal role in the region. The three leaders, Olaf Scholz, Emmanuel Macron and Donald Tusk, meet in Berlin tomorrow. And to tell us more about it, I'm delighted to say that Michal Baranowski, managing director of the German Marshall Fund East and its regional director for Poland, joins me on the line now. A very good afternoon to you, Michal.
Great to be with you.
Now, we know this grouping as the Weimar Triangle, didn't we? It was established in Weimar in what, about 1991, as Poland was emerging from communism, and this alliance was built to help Poland. How much do you believe that the tables are turning today?
Well, right now, Europe needs new leadership. The German-French engine is not working very, very well. Poland is certainly emerging after 8 years of law and justice rule as a strong European voice. It's also a country that understands security very well, both because of what we are bordering Ukraine, that is right now at war with, that is being attacked by Russia, also because Poland is spending 4% on defense. So it's a serious heavyweight player joining the core of European leadership.
And how much does that change the balance? Because you mentioned the fact that France and Germany have not been functioning terribly efficiently in the last few years. Poland has been out of the game for a while, given the fact that its Law and Justice Party had sought to not necessarily sever ties with the European Union, but would go in its own direction, which the European Union did not like at all. Now we have Donald Tusk. What strengths do we see coming from this reunion of the Weimar Triangle?
So this is, I think this is a moment where Weimar Triangle can really play the role that it could not have played any other time in its history. That particular meeting, but broadly this way of thinking, recognizes that Europe needs to step up, especially when it comes to security and defense. And that's why the leaders are meeting, to really discuss what Europe, under the leadership of these three countries, can do to help Ukraine militarily very much in the short term. Tusk is just coming from Washington, where he saw that Americans and American administration, despite best intention, is not able to provide the necessary ammunition to Ukraine because of the block in Congress. So now it's time for Weimar.
Just at the point when 5 billion euros worth of funding is to be given to Ukraine as part of efforts to make sure that Ukraine can successfully win the war against the Russians. The fact that we now have this funding, that came about after internal wranglings, didn't it? That there was issues about the bi-European, there was issues about the amount of money that countries would receive in return for all this.
That's right. I mean, building a consensus around the aid for Ukraine is not the easiest process, even though if we really look at how united Europe and the transatlantic space has been able to be since the attack 2 years ago, it's really quite tremendous. But this is, you know, we are going back to the question that a new leadership is needed, and this is a moment in which Tusk, given the pro-democratic mandate that he was given by the Polish people, given Poland's seriousness about security, and given Poland's understanding of the threat, is bringing a new quality to the other two key countries, France and Germany. And the thinking behind it is that if those three countries can agree, then the rest of the EU really will have a much easier time finding a common point, and perhaps can just follow what the three countries of quite different perspectives were able to agree, especially on issues of security, of European security and defence.
What quality, you mentioned Poland brings in fresh quality to the situation. What is that quality, and how welcome do you think that Donald Tusk's arrival to pull together Olaf Scholz and Emmanuel Macron will be?
There are a number of qualities that Poland is bringing. One, and Tusk in particular, one is a very strong mandate and pro-democratic mandate. The elections on October 15th that Tusk won was the highest turnout in Polish history, 74%, with large majority in the parliament. That's good. Poland is bringing large population, the largest military budget as a proportion of GDP, but also the democratic credentials and a high mandate that Tusk is bringing, given the highest turnout in Polish election ever, 74% in the election of last October.
Tell us a little bit more about the commitments that are being asked of NATO and European Union members. I think it's the Polish president has said that, that's Andrzej Duda, has said that NATO members must now spend 3% of their GDP on defence, not least because Poland is bordering Ukraine and can feel the effect as keenly as anybody else can. But when you look at France wanting to spend, just 2% of GDP on NATO, and Germany's defence minister talking about spending as much as 3.5% of economic output. What does that say about the difference in levels of commitment from different countries?
The proposal of spending 3% on defence is in recognition of times changing. For years, we lived in peaceful Europe, where all the countries, including Poland, could take advantage of peace dividend. This all has changed in February, 2 years ago, when Russia launched a new full-scale invasion on Ukraine. Since then, Poland started to spend almost 4% on defense. And Poland is a leader in saying, look, everyone else, the time of peace are unfortunately over. The threats to European security are real. And we need to go back to levels that were relatively normal during Cold War times. And that's much closer to 3% than 2%, which is what NATO countries agreed to spend by this year. So it's basically another goal for the future growth of capabilities that NATO and European Union needs to maintain European peace.
Mikhail Baranovsky, thank you so much, as ever, for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Briefing. Sixteen here in London. Time now to have a look at the papers. I'm delighted to say I'm joined in the studio today by Christopher Phillips, Professor of International Relations at Queen Mary University of London and the author of Battleground, 10 Conflicts That Explain the New Middle East. Hello, Chris. Nice to see you. Let's begin with an area very much of your focus, which is the Red Sea attacks, the Houthi rebels causing absolute chaos when it comes to disrupting the flow of trade across the world. It appears, according to a report in the Financial Times, that the United States talked to Iran about this. Tell us more.
Yeah, so the headline in the FT was Washington held secret talks with Iran in push to halt Red Sea attacks. And what it transpires is that back in January, the US did hold indirect talks with Iran in Oman, which is acting as the broker between the two. They were indirect talks. They never actually met face to face. But the subject matter was those attacks by Houthi rebels on Red Sea shipping. And what seems to have happened is the US did effectively lobby Iran to use its influence with the Houthis to try to stop those Red Sea attacks. Now, Iran has insisted they don't really have that level of influence. You know, they're often characterized as Iran's proxies, but Iran insisted we don't have that level of control over them. We just share spiritual and ideological and political connections.
You're sort of smiling as you say that.
Well, it's a debated point as to the extent to which they can control the Houthi rebels. What's interesting, actually, about this report is that Iran clearly has closer control over its Shia militia in Iraq and Syria, which recently attacked U.S. positions in Jordan, because after the US responded to those militia in Syria and Iraq, Iran clearly has influenced them, and there haven't been any subsequent assaults on US positions. It seems from this report that actually Iran is either choosing not to or is not able to exercise the same level of influence over the Houthis.
And what does this report say about the level of the United States and how much it may have or may not have in the region?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. This was one of several planned talks. These occurred in January. There was meant to be more talks in February, but they were postponed because of efforts being made by the US to broker a deal between Israel and Hamas, which ultimately seems to have failed. And what it shows is that the US is extending its influence. It's willing to use diplomatic tracks as well as military influence in the region. But it's also showing, on both cases, it's not being that successful so far.
Let's move to a story in the Times of an almost Shakespearean scale tale of revenge.
Yes, so this is the story that former South African President Jacob Zuma has formed a new party in South Africa called MK, which is seriously challenging, in certain parts of South Africa anyway, the dominant ANC party that he used to rule in the upcoming elections in May. And what's so fascinating about this story is it has so many layers to it. So on the one hand, there's the personal level, which is Zuma was actually unseated as president and leader of the ANC by the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa. And it's possible that if Zuma is successful, he won't form a majority by the looks of it. He's currently polling at about 13%. But he will seriously dent the ANC. And if the ANC, which has always won over 50% of the vote in all of South Africa's elections since the end of apartheid, it's currently polling at 39%. If it fails to hit that 50% mark, it's highly possible that Ramaphosa will be deposed as leader of the ANC. So Zuma, in this kind of revenge tale, seems to be absolutely maximising his political leverage to try to unseat the person who he blames for his own fall from power.
And if the ANC is unseated, who is left to fill the gap? There is no single body or party which could replace them.
Yes, when we say unseat, it would just mean that they would lose their controlling majority. They would still be the largest party, would have to go into coalition with one of the various opposition groups. There's some that are more on the centre-right and those on the sort of more far left who are more in favour of reclaiming, for example, white majority businesses and a more equal distribution of power. It would equal distribution of wealth, rather. So it really would shift the dynamics of post-apartheid politics. There's also the global dimension as well, which is that Zuma is quite close to Vladimir Putin and in the past has called him a man of peace.
Yes, this is an interesting thing because Zuma is A, 81 years old, B, he was unseated, C, he was jailed for refusing to testify in an inquiry about corruption, D, released for an undisclosed medical condition, and I could go on. He goes to Russia for treatment, doesn't he? So this plays enormously into the geopolitical issues, doesn't it? And where this country lies and where and who it deals with and who its allies are.
Absolutely. And it's very much an unexpected turn in South African politics that could really make those May elections really key, not just in South Africa, but globally as well.
Let's finally talk about some very large hailstones in Kansas. It's kind of a picture story, so you're going to have to, you know, do a bit of heavy lifting here, Chris, as to describe how big this hail is.
Sure. So this is a report in The Guardian called Gorilla Hail Expected in Parts of Kansas and Missouri. And I think the best way of describing it is utilising the text itself. Someone's talking about gorilla hail, which is the size of a baseball. And someone is quoted, Reed Timmer, who's a storm chaser and covers these kind of issues. He describes it as gorilla hail because it's the size of a baseball. And another commentator noted that when you get up to tennis ball, baseball, or God forbid, softball size, then they can do tremendous amounts of damage. And they do sound absolutely terrifying.
At least they're not the size of a gorilla. Chris Phillips, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Breakfast time in Sao Paulo, well, late breakfast-ish, at 9:23 a.m, which is where we head now to join our senior correspondent and music curator, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. He's on the line from Sao Paulo to bring us the global countdown. Bom dia!
Bom dia, Emma. And by the way, I do love a late breakfast, I have to say. You know me that, right?
Are we at breakfast time yet where you are? Are we still like warming up a bit?
No, I think we are at breakfast. So we're it's 9:24 a.m. here in São Paulo. It's a lovely sunny day. In fact, it's funny because I came from London, right? So I'm loving the heat. But I think people here, they're complaining because apparently it's going to be 36 on Saturday. And yeah, people are not happy about that. I am.
Okay,
I am.
Yeah, send them this way. We'll put them right.
Exactly. I agree with you 100%.
So in this terrible situation that you find yourself in, enjoying the prospect of a late breakfast in warm weather, you've had to tear yourself away from what I can only describe as a nice time to find us some nice music. Now, that's always a debatable issue when it comes to adjectives on the global countdown, but you're going to dissuade us of the... Well, you're going to persuade us otherwise, aren't you, Faye? Where do we begin? What kind of music are we looking at today?
Well, first of all, today's a special one. I'm not looking necessarily at the Brazilian charts. So basically, this is my five tips of new Brazilian music, what you should be listening. Although not all of those artists are in the charts, they're very successful. People are listening and enjoying themselves here on the dance floor, listening to the songs. I hope you like. It's very varied in a way. We're starting something quite smooth and beautiful. It's typical MPB, which is this genre, which is this post-bossa nova kind of vibe in Brazilian music, mixing samba, jazz, a little bit of rock. This is JP. He's actually from São Paulo with the band Gilsons.
dia que a saudade iria fazer tanto drama. Dormir no meu peito todo dia, morar no teu lado da cama.
Well, that was all rather velvety, wasn't it? I mean, it's all very terribly smooth and how much of an impact is that kind of music making on the Brazilian market? Because it's lovely, but I can't really say I could remember humming the tune much after hearing it for the first time.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, of course, Brazilians love country music and funk. They are massive genres on the radio. But I think there is a space for this type of music as well, which is, to be honest, where Brazilian music used to be known in the 70s and the 80s. And the band, talking about those legendary musicians, Gilsons, they are... one of them is the son of Gilberto Gil, which is a Brazilian music legend, and two of them are the grandsons of Gilberto Gil. So they are kind of continuing this tradition from the great Gilberto Gil, which I think you know, Emma, because I know you like some Brazilian music.
I do. I love it. And I love the fact that generations continue. It's something rather special and precious about Brazil's music. As it is, its flamboyance, speaking of which, number four, please.
I mean, number four is extremely flamboyant, is a drag queen pop star. She's one of the biggest pop stars in Brazil, without a doubt. And this time she mixed what Brazilians love, which is kind of, it's slightly cheesy, but also it's a cover of a Roxette track. And I'll tell you this later, Emma, but Brazilians are obsessed with Roxette. There's been multiple articles on the topic, including one that I did on Monaco. But let's have a listen. Pablo Vittar with Pede Pra Eu Ficar, the version of Listen to Your Heart.
So there we are, a Brazilian drag queen covering Roxette with a rather fruity, if rather lame, video as well. Do go and have a look at it if you sort of want to watch it sort of from behind the sofa.
I love a fruity video.
It's so fruity.
It's so fruity. It's so delicious. It's very, oh God, it's summer. It's distilled summer there. I'm a big fan of Pablo. And can I say something, Emma? Pierre Gasly, the surviving member of Roxette, he did listen to this track and he said he loved it. He said, it changes a few things from the original one, but it's approved. It's approved by Roxette.
In which case, it gets the thumbs up from Monocle.
Yes.
Number three, a terrible video, nice mid-century house. I've forgotten the song already.
It's a beautiful track. I mean,
it's all right.
This has been a new discovery for me. It's Tuyo. It's a band from the south of Brazil. And, you know, they mix kind of folk pop, a little bit of ambient music. And this track, it's together with Luigi Luna, which I interviewed her for Monaco magazine a few years ago. I mean, she's great. It's all about contemplation. It's all about being connected to nature in a way, tranquil landscapes. You know, I need to show you all the different vibes, Emma. Let's have a listen to Tuyo and Luigi Luna, Paisagem.
There you are, showing me all the vibes. Thank you, Faye, for that. It sort of has a kind of like a mid-80s Alexandra O'Neill kind of vibe to it.
I love it.
I love the building in the video. The rest of it, I'm afraid I've forgotten it.
Oh, don't be so harsh. I'm joking. But at number two, I think, do you want something a little bit more up-tempo?
Yes, I want people dancing in underwear.
Well, I mean, you're in the right song because look at the lyrics of this next track before I introduce this. I miss you now, I'll see you in the evening. I want to groove on top of you. Much better.
Ooh,
that's the lyrics of this track.
Faye, it's 20, but it's only 9:30 in the morning where you are. It's clearly very warm.
I'm just doing my job as a journalist. Let's have a listen to the great Duda Beat from Recife with Saudade de Você.
I feel as if I need to be with some inappropriate friends in a car with a window down. I think maybe your geographical location has formed your choice this week in a very, very obvious way. That this is all hot weather music. If you're crawling around in boots and your anorak in the United Kingdom, this seems like a very, very long way away, Faye. So we're immensely grateful for the warmth that you are sending to the Northern Hemisphere.
Thank you very much. And she's great. She's fun. And did you notice the Miami-based beats as well? So she kind of liked to mix the genres as well. I loved the beat.
No,
I think it's a great song for the summer.
I didn't notice that, but I did notice a video with the people in their wife once. Put some clothes on, Brazil. Right, finally, a song, your number one top favourite, and something that actually is on the Monocle radio playlist. So, sort of killing two birds with one stone here. We have Cursed Early Mornings, is that correct?
Is that correct? And you know, it's time for some existential disco. The next artist, he started his career as kind of a rapper. I mean, there's a lot of hip hop elements to his music, but his latest album, it's a little bit of funk, a little bit of disco, but as I said, existential. He questioned, is there life outside Earth? You know, he talks about happiness, but don't worry, we can still dance. It's FBC with Madrugada Maldita.
Online por aí, madrugada maldita.
That's pretty well put together. I mean, existential disco. What next, Faye?
Yes, I love existential disco, I have to say, because I'm a quite thoughtful person. Sometimes I'm dancing and I'm thinking about my life and all the problems. You know, it's funny.
It's funny. I must ask you, what for those of us who aren't intimately acquainted with existential disco, what is it?
Well, it's disco that makes you think about life outside Earth, or you know, or you have to pay your bills.
You've had a lot of sun, haven't you, Faye, since you were
I
there?
did.
It's very warm. Faye, thank you so much for joining us on the line from São Paulo, and we will be posting that little conversation online as its own individual segment in a little while, so you can go back and enjoy every single track in its entirety. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you so much for joining us. And that's all the time we have for today's edition of The Briefing. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to the producer, Lillian Fawcett. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.